So I am going to use the blackboard, so if people want to see better, you could conceivably fill out the symmetry. I think there's a lot of inertia in the system. Well, I've never actually spoke to an audience configuration with this geometry before. This is, and students get out of hand. First, let me tell you the kind of three main topics I'm going to talk about today. If you can't hear me, then I really suggest you pull up your chairs. So actually, working backwards, kind of what the title suggests is talking about the force balance that exists in multi-gravitational objects, or BPS objects. And in particular, as the title suggests, I'm going to look at the force balance between gravitational spin-spin and magnetic dipole-dipole interactions. Okay. The method that I'm going to use mostly to examine this force balance, so you can keep in your mind as a canonical example the multi-extremal Reisner-Noertzian black holes. So you have Q equals M black holes and solutions in which you can have, pick your favorite number, say 17 of them, put down anywhere and they're in equilibrium with each other, or at least they don't move. So we're going to have the spin on them too. That's how you get the spin-spin. The method that we're going to use to kind of talk about this Newtonian concept of force and see how the forces cancel is to use test objects as probes. So we're going to make test objects that have similar properties to the self-gravitating background black objects and look at the force balance that happens on these probes. So we'll use test particles or higher dimensional objects, membranes, as a mechanism for probing the force balance. And there's actually going to be two kinds of test objects I want to talk about. One is a classical. And by classical, I mean that you start with some classical blob of stress energy, which includes mass charge, and in this case, rotation, and consider a point particle limit of that. So you have some generalization of the geodesic equation, but now the particle's endowed with spin. And a quantum mechanical test object, and the quantum mechanical version of that will be via supersymmetry. So where I actually want to start is in terms of talking about the background objects, the space-times themselves, in which you have black brains of various dimensions, black holes, and black two brains are the main examples I'm going to talk about, that are endowed with mass, charge, and spin or angular momentum. Because it actually turns out to be rather interesting to think about there's kind of two types of processes by which you can put angular momentum and hence magnetic field on charged black holes or charged black brains. On charged black holes. So again, there's going to be two strategies that I want to mention for this. One is a classical strategy in which you add angular momentum. See, they're having more fun than we are. We have to get some laughter here. A classical strategy for adding angular momentum and magnetic field to a charged black hole, and a quantum mechanical strategy, which I think is rather neat, the way it works out, again, using supersymmetry. So I'm going to start with number one. This was the outline. Now comes the introduction, and then I'll say some more explicit things. Okay. Some number of years ago, I can't really remember, in my advancing age, Garfinkel and I were working on a calculation in which we were trying to understand, in some sense of the word understand, why the gyromagnetic ratio of a black hole it has G equals 2. One of those interesting facts. So I actually learned something interesting from that calculation. So suppose you have a black hole that has mass and charge but no angular momentum. And now we're going to put angular momentum on it and compute the gyromagnetic ratio. And that kind of happens. There's two limits to this calculation in which the answer interpolates between G equals 1, which I'll think of as the Jackson case. I mean, so if you open up Jackson electrodynamics and read about how to calculate a gyromagnetic ratio, if you have some mass that has charge, and in this situation it was orbiting the black hole, so it's a current loop, then you can use Jackson. It's a far field, gravity's not important, and calculate the gyromagnetic ratio of this system, and you get G equals 1. If you bring this particle closer and closer till the limit where it actually reaches the black hole horizon and is still doing this orbiting thing, what we found is that if you take the put mass on the particle, of course, but you can actually set the charge equal to 0, that is to say the answer is independent of charge, what one finds that because, when you think about it, it's obvious, because this particle is orbiting and it has angular momentum then generated in the space-time, from Maxwell's equations, there'll be magnetic field generated just by virtue of having mass. You don't need a current loop. Okay, so because of the gravitational interaction, just a rotating mass will generate angular momentum and therefore B field in the space-time, and you compute the G ratio, the gyromagnetic ratio, for that situation, and you get G equals 2. So that in this system, as you get to the black hole limit, you're letting the angular momentum reside closer and closer to the horizon. The charge of the particle isn't important. It's just the fact that there's mass going around. Of course, you need the background electric field. Okay. Well, I thought that was interesting. This is the first ingredient I want to mention. About a year after doing that, I came across a paper by Rebbe and Jakiv. Which is an older paper, 1976. And they were looking at fermionic zero modes in the background of a monopole. So they started with some monopole solution. Actually, they looked at several cases, but I'll just summarize. They started a monopole, a nice bosonic soliton. And they said, okay, suppose there's actually a fermion in this system. And they found that if you solve the Dirac-type equation for the fermion in the background of the monopole, that there actually were static, that is to say zero-energy solutions for the fermion. This then had the implication that there was spin, intrinsic spin angular momentum, attached to this monopole. So when I read that, I thought, oh, this is really neat. Because if you could do a gravitational analog of this, you could take this calculation, where now instead of having classical angular momentum by virtue of this mass rotating, you have intrinsic spin quantum mechanical angular momentum put on a fermionic field, that wasn't rotating the black hole but had angular momentum because it had intrinsic spin didn't have to carry charge, but likewise from the loop we had already studied, because it has spin and it's in a gravitating background with charge, there would be not only angular momentum but magnetic field induced in the background space-time, and you'd have a gyromagnetic ratio. So I thought, oh, if you could do for monopoles the gravitating case, that would be really cool, because you could get gyromagnetic ratio from just having these zero-energy static fermions there. But I didn't know what to do with it, and there were at least three problems that I could think of. One was the no-hair theorems. I mean, kind of canonically, we're brought up to think that you can't put these static fields on backgrounds of black holes. But, of course, no-hair theorems are really theorems that you prove case by case. And although I knew that Jim Hartle had proved a no-hair theorem, I think, for neutrinos on a Schwarzschild background, you know, maybe there was some other case that actually gave you allowed to have some kind of fermionic hair that hadn't been treated yet. So it's a case-by-case thing. So this seemed like a possible problem, but maybe not insurmountable. More significantly were the problems of kind of mixing quantum fields and classical fields and gravity. So it's like you throw fermions in the system, they're quantum mechanical. Do you couple to the stress energy? And if you couple to the stress energy, well, that has its own problems with it in terms of, is that really the right thing to do? I mean, expectation value of the stress energy, is it right to couple to the expectation value? If you don't couple to the expectation value of the stress energy, then you have this problem where you have a classical field, the metric, and fermions running around in their same system, and putting them equal to each other is always one of those problems. So the issues of gravity and quantum mechanics, I didn't really know what to do with. But anyways, I thought it was a kind of a neat idea, and it somewhere is registered in the back of my mind. A little bit over a year ago, I did put the references up there because this, as you probably noticed by now, is a Blackboard talk, so there aren't transparencies to put on the web. This is work that I was about to say we, and I realized I hadn't defined we. This is work that I've done with Vijay Balasubramanian, David Castor, KZ Nguyen, who's not in the room, he's a graduate student at UMass, and me. So when I say we, it's some collection of those people generically. We're looking at this issue of force balance a little over a year ago, and this really neat paper by Eichelberg and Embacher from 1986. So they had written this some time ago, but I didn't see it until like about a year ago. They did part of this Revy and Jakive, or they did this Revy and Jakive type construction in the background of a Reiser-Nordstrom black hole. So they took a Q equals M black hole in four space-time dimensions, and utilizing supersymmetry, first generated non-zero gravitino field on this background, so they explicitly showed that solutions, well-behaved solutions, exist. And then they iterated the supersymmetry transformations to construct what the back reaction was on the metric and the gauge field to construct the space-times. So this actually was the realization, which existed at the time when I was reading Revy and Jakive, this was the realization of the zero modes back reacting on the fermionic zero modes causing angular momentum and magnetic field in the background of a charged black hole that I'm kind of wondering about. So this is kind of the end of the introduction. I'll go through now and say some things that more explicitly about these ideas, but this is kind of where I'm headed for the next, whatever, 20 minutes. So I thought this was really, really neat. I mean, if the Revy and Jakive construction was cool, then I think they're construction is definitely far out. They, you know, display space-times that have magnetic field by virtue of having intrinsic fermionic ground state spin as opposed to classical masses moving around. Okay, so let me I'll get a little bit more explicit about these things. Yeah. Yeah, I'll say some more about it right now. I'll see, in a minute. No, in the n equals 4 case, you can iterate it. It takes 4 iterations of the supersymmetry transformation, and then it stops because they're fermions. So they actually wrote it down explicitly. Okay. The examples that I'm going to add in. I'll use the word soliton loosely. The examples that I'll be referring to is first the monopole, which was the Revy and Dekeev case. The Reiser-Nordström Q equals M black hole in 4 dimensions. Eichelberg and Embacher. The case that we all looked at recently was a two-brain in 11 space-time dimensions, M2-brain in 11 dimensions. That's us, not US. And I should also mention, although I'm not going to probably say anything about this, there was a paper by Mike Duff, Lou, and Romfeld,
LIU,
a little over a year ago, I think, on D0 brains in 10 dimensions. Okay, and they did a very similar kind of construction. I'm not going to actually talk about their paper, but I wanted to mention that they did a very similar type construction. Okay. So what Revy and Dekeev pointed out is that if you have, you start with some bosonic solution. And then you say, look, there's really a fermion in our theory. I mean, so you have to kind of commit yourself to what world you're living in. But suppose there actually is this fermion, although it's not excited explicitly in the solution. So if there's really this fermion in your theory, and in the cases, the gravitating cases, this of course will be the gravitino, and this satisfies some Dirac type equation, what they did was to, if there exists static or zero energy solutions for psi, then if you think about the implications of that when you quantize the field psi, so when we write down the expansion for a field as a quantum field, it has some usual time-dependent oscillatory part. But now in the presence of these zero energy pieces, we want to sum over all the independent zero modes so there might be some number of zero energy solutions with some coefficients. The symmetries of the situation, and in the case I'll talk about will be the supersymmetry, will imply that there's some algebra that these coefficients, which then become operators, the coefficients of the zero mode, satisfy. And in all the cases I'll talk about, that can always be put in the usual creation and annihilation operator form. So you have, in addition to the time-dependent piece for your field, a contribution from the zero modes. The coefficients of the zero mode satisfy this algebra. What Revy and Dekeev point out is that your ground states have to sit in a representation of this algebra. So you might have started with one bosonic solution, But then you find out you actually have a degenerate set of equal energy solutions of your ground states. That set of states is defined by this algebra, and that's your system. You have this multiplet instead of having a single object.
So the psi a's are defined by being solutions to E slash psi a zero.
Right.
And the static.
So these are the static solutions. Okay. So, for example, one of the cases that Revy and Jakeev looked at, you have this monopole, and they turned out that they had one solution to that, which meant that the monopole actually, instead of being a spin zero object, when you took into account the fermions, you had a plus h bar over 2 and a minus h bar over 2, spin plus or minus a half states. So although you started out with something that you thought of as spin zero, if you really do have fermions in that theory that they're looking at, it really isn't a spin zero object at all. There's either a plus a half or a minus a half option.
Why is that? Why can't you just set psi equals zero? I mean, if you have a non-zero psi, maybe, but isn't psi equals zero still?
So the point of view that they take, which is the point of view that we also have, is that the world is quantum mechanical, and that let's think about a theory that actually has this field. If you're studying big, heavy solitons, there's certainly many classical aspects of that soliton that are great for looking at to understand the physics. What they're pointing out is that there's this aspect of the quantum mechanics of the system due to these zero-energy solutions that it's wrong to get rid of. So why is it wrong? Well, there's a difference between having, in one way of looking at the world, according to your suggestion, Rob, there would be a spin zero object, just the bosonic monopole. In their solutions, that doesn't exist. It's either plus or minus a half. So that's something that you could actually test, right? You throw a monopole through, I guess, an electric field and see if it has spin, if it's deflected. Okay. So their claim is that if you're working with these kind of monopoles in this theory and you throw them through an electric field, yes, they will be deflected by the right amount for plus or minus a half, and that you won't find any monopoles that don't have spin. So they think this is an intrinsic part of the ground state, and if you want to get that experiment right, you can understand the effect from the zero modes. So it changes the vacuum.
The first question are you forced to change your vacuum, or is it optional?
Yeah. So.
Well, I can see clearly that you can do it. Whether you must do it, like what in the equations tells you that's not there?
Well, it doesn't satisfy that algebra.
Yeah.
The fermion is not satisfied as an empty.
But zero satisfies. I mean, if I put zero,
no,
psi is zero.
Because there's this delta function on the right hand side.
Well, no, I know that. I know the a's being zero don't satisfy it. But if I set psi to zero.
What do you mean by setting psi to zero? It's a fermion, right? Fermions don't really have a classical limit. It's a question of what you mean by the classical limit. You've got to be careful about where your h bars go, and be careful. And in the classical, in the semi-classical limit, you're obliged to put in things that satisfy the algebra. You could put it another way, that I'm not sure if you're going.
So you're saying non-zero h-bar forces that algebra to be present.
Yeah, there's an h-bar floating around that, of course, you're always depressed. H-bar equals 1, and to take the classical limit, we have to normalize our creation annihilation operator back to the 1 over h-bar and stuff.
Okay.
Well, I think that you can also check it experimentally. That, again, there's a difference between having a spin-zero monopole and having one that has spin a half. Now, maybe that deflection of plus or minus h bar over 2 might be small compared to something else that sets the scale of a monopole, sure, but it's still there. So there's a prediction about a physical effect as well. In Minkowski space. Well, that you have these zero-energy So if you wanted to solve the Dirac equation in Minkowski space, static, what's the solution?
Zero was one.
Zero is also a solution here. This is the main point.
But there's no, but there's other solutions. Are there any other solutions?
I think the question is.
That we'll get there.
Actually, going to get to that. I mean, she's going to set up the angular momentum operator to build up of this object. And the question of whether there exists space within is that angular momentum operator gives you an alpha value zero. Are there any
something? Did you want to add something?
I think Jenny is going to get to that.
Okay, so what Eichelberg and Embacher did, again, was to consider this effect, although maybe not from this point of view, for extremal Q equals M Reisner-Orsen black holes in four space-time dimensions. Now, I'm sure, as you know, there's several ways in which you can think of this as a ground state. They have zero temperature, so they don't Hawking radiate. For these objects, you can write down multi-black hole objects so that different ones are in equilibrium with each other. And from the point of view of positive energy theorem, these are the lowest energy states for fixed charge. Now, these space-times have the property that they break half the total possible supersymmetry. There's two unbroken, that two if you're making them complex supersymmetries, and those are the spinners that you use to do the positive energy construction on the basis, and two broken supersymmetries. What Eichelberg and Embacher observed and then carried out was that you can use the broken supersymmetries to generate actually something different. So you can use those symmetries to generate non-zero gravitino field, for example. So that was the first step, that what they did. So you take these broken supersymmetries and use it to generate gravitino. So there's the first objection that I mentioned a long time ago about hair. Here they actually explicitly generate a solution for the gravitino field, and it's well behaved. So there, the no hair theorem is not an impediment in this example. Let's see. So each of these supersymmetries you can parameterize by a spinner. The difference between the broken and unbroken is conveniently represented by a projection condition. Each of these gravitinos parameterized by this particular spinner that satisfies the right projection condition generates supercharge via the asymptotic behavior of the gravitino at infinity. So from that point of view, we can understand the fact of this gravitino hair. I mean, it makes absolute sense in retrospect. There's another long-range charge. So we expect to actually have this kind of long-range hair. Now, in the Reisner-Nordström case, what they found is that when you sum over the zero modes, time-dependent, But in this case, there were two complex parameters. So the algebra that the ground states had to satisfy was this one. And they found, then if you examine what kind of states actually sit in this now degenerate ground state multiplet, there are two spin zero states and two spin a half. So instead of just having this one object rise in Nordstrom black hole with no spin, actually degenerate in energy in the presence of this fermion are two more states, another spin zero and plus or minus a half. So this single object has been expanded. The ground states have to sit in a representation of this algebra, and that forms this multiplet. Okay. For the M2 brain in D equals 11, you get a similar expression, but now the parameter A, B run over 1 through 8. So in that case, the ground state sits in this, it's a much bigger multiplet, it actually has 256 states. One of them is a scalar, and you can fill out the multiplet by acting with the creation operators and start somewhere and move yourself around to the different numbers. Okay. The next thing I was going to do is talk about the back reaction. So far, all I've said is something is about generating gravitinos. Now I want to get to the back reaction on the metric and come back to the other point that I was wondering about many years ago of, like, what do you now do with these fermions that are going to rattle around inside your metric? So are there any other questions? Any comments? Okay, so the back reaction. So maybe I'll put down the metrics. So I'll put down the Reiser-Nordstrom Q equals M, because then that'll make the next one, if it's not so familiar, for the M2 brain look more natural. So for this one, I don't remember. I'm using H for harmonic function. Everything is determined by one harmonic function. And it's multi-object in the sense that you can have things at these various different centers. For the M2 brain, the form of the metric is very similar. Now the symmetry direction it's a two brain, so it has time one and two directions. So we have for the black hole, there was kind of just one direction parallel to the world volume, and that was time. In this case, I left off a minus sign. You're all too polite to say that. So it's a very similar kind of form. H is again for harmonic, although it's a different harmonic function. Falls off like 1 over r to the 6. Again, you have a gauge field that's an electric sort. So we just have components parallel to the world volume, 1 over h. So those, I wanted to put the metrics on the board in case they weren't familiar to anybody. Okay, so these are the bosonic spacetimes that one starts with. And then so notice that in this example, there wasn't, doing supergravity, you don't have the question, do we couple to the expectation value of the stress energy of the fermions, or what do we couple with? I mean, the theory is given to you. It might be right. It might be wrong. You might like it. You might not like it. But anyways, it's a consistent framework to work in. So we don't have to worry about what we couple to. That's determined by the theory. What Eichelberg and Embacher did was to first do the first supersymmetry transformation to generate the gravitino, and then you can iterate it. In their case, because of four dimensions, they only had to iterate four times, and they got the full exact solution. For the M2 brain, you'd have to iterate 16 times, so we didn't do it. We just calculated the leading term, and that was certainly enough. What you find in terms of space-time angular momentum, for example, so this is the back reaction, is that suppose I have, here's my M2 brain, and I'll use alpha for a tangent direction, tangent to the brain, and I for a perpendicular direction. So if we're looking for angular momentum, we'll look at the far field for some metric component that's a mixed form, GI alpha, the off-diagonal piece. And what one finds is that it has the following type structure. I'm not going to put labels on these. The A's are the expansion coefficients in the zero modes that are still on the board. Then there's some gamma matrix structure. So you have something that's typically of this form. It's quadratic in these coefficients that satisfy our algebra of the zero modes. And it has some gamma matrix stuff. I realize, as I said, that I didn't mention how you actually determine what this algebra is. I said, I guess, a while ago that the symmetries of the situation would determine it. In this case, because the gravitino, for example, the far field of that carries a supercharge, like we said, like I said, and you agreed. You can, from the algebra of the supercharges, you can infer the commutation, the anti-commutation relations, or you can use the canonical anti-commutation relations for the psi field itself, or better yet, you can use both and see that they agree, which they do. Okay. So the symmetries determine the algebra for the A's. So we have this kind of object, now let's look at it. So this is this component of the space-time metric. Quadratic in these operators.
An even element of that algebra, but it's not a key number.
Yes. And isn't that interesting? So this was kind of like the third puzzle in the list of puzzles that I put down earlier, is that so we haven't coupled to the expectation value, the stress energy of the fermions, and the result about that is that the metric is operator valued. So the metric is operator valued. If you want to turn that into a nice C number function, then you have to take the expectation value, for example, in one of these degenerate ground states. So you need, for example, an expectation value of the metric to get C number functions. Okay. In the four-dimensional case, you can represent the A's as if you go from complex representation to a real representation, then that's just the Dirac algebra. In the four-dimensional case, then they're 4x4-dimensional matrices. So you actually have these 4x4-dimensional matrices, which, as Ted pointed out, are operators sitting in your metric. And if you write it that way, then it's clear that they're operators. In the 11-dimensional case, then again, it's a Dirac algebra. And the A's turn out to be 256x256 dimensional matrices. Okay. So if you there's nothing particularly wrong with that. You have this nice multitude of ground states, four states in the Reiser-Norrison black hole case, 256 states to choose from in your 11-dimensional M2 brain case. Take the expectation value in one of them, and your favorite one. See, and that's how you see what the spin content is. I should say, too, that this operator, you can check its commutation relations, and as Vijay mentioned before, it does satisfy the right commutation relations to actually be a spin operator. So you can, this is a spin from what we'd expect in terms of where it sits in the space-time metric. I mean, we know which far field components have to have what form to be space-time angular momentum. It's also a spin operator, and that satisfies the right commutation relations for the algebra of the right dimension, depending on which case you're looking at. So it's reasonable to call that the spin. The metric is not diagonal, no. You mean, are there spin zero states?
No, it's just I mean, there's an ADM J here, right? And that J is now operator value.
That's right.
So it's what Steve said, it's not diagonalizable. I mean, you can diagonal J Z as you can have eigenvalues of J Z and J squared.
So it's not expectation values to get out numerical values.
Yeah. Well, it's not a function until you take an expectation value. Okay. In the M2 brain case that we looked at, one of the members of the multiset, as I mentioned, is spin zero. I should mention, because it's kind of interesting, that in the 10-dimensional D0 brain case that Duff et al. Looked at, there was no thing that was a scalar under rotations in the space transverse to the world line. So it's a little, that's a kind of a particularly interesting case, which is actually what started us thinking about this, that you start with this object that's just a bosonic black hole, I mean, no fermionic field, do the supersymmetry transformation, that's what Duff, Liu, Ramfeld did, and they find when they end up, actually, they never had a spin zero member to their multiplet of ground states at all. So that was actually one of the things that prompted us to look at these issues. I don't know.
Well, it's either whatever the rank of the.
Is there a concept of. Oh, sorry.
If you use this metric to calculate some operator value in ADM mass, do you know whether that is degenerate on this whole multiplier?
Well, they all have the same mass by construction. Yes, so that part, the ADM mass part doesn't change. So that's why I'm calling them degenerate states.
It's only J that's an operator, right? At least in what you do.
Well, no, you have operator pieces and all the components of the metric. But they all have the same mass. And if you take the expectation value in any state,
so the mass, same mass. ADM mass is not a quantum operator?
Well, that component of the metric has operators in it, but I guess by the time you're at infinity, those corrections fall off so fast that they're not relevant for that calculation. Yeah, that's what maybe that's what you're asking. Yeah, that's right. Okay.
But this is not a spin number, even at
infinity. Yeah.
Is there some concept then of space-like separation? And you have a metric that's operator values, so I should know the things I make out of. I mean, my quantum operators need to be well-defined in space-like separations, don't they? But if the metric's operator value, how do I know if it's space-like separation?
Oh, you mean, like, how do you compute distance?
Yeah.
To know, like, what the distance is?
Yeah. I need an expectation value to find the distance, but I don't know how to find the distance until I have the expectation value.
Well, so instead of giving you some glib answer, I think I give you an answer that I have not thought about all the different physical things one can measure using this metric. Since all that you've done is kind of add spin in a way parallel to what Revy and Jakeep did on the monopole, I think there's probably no problem with any of those issues. Let's see about it.
Well,
I didn't hear what the first, I don't have.
The operators are not really functions of space time.
But the so the coefficients, I mean, these are what I left off here. For example, the function of R or the X. Yeah, I mean, so yes and no. I mean, no, I'm not getting your question. Wait, you have some soliton.
I thought your question was, you have a metric that has operators in it. What do I mean by this?
Yeah.
So it's pretty much
my question. What do I mean by space like that? Well, but we had no distance,
We wrote down the distance and had these operators in it. So if it only makes mean, if it's only meaningful as a number, after you take an expectation about it, what exactly is the first one? That's a different question.
But the point of this question is, you're trying to ask about quantum causality.
Sure.
You're unfairly using space like that, right?
Sure.
I was going to say, you think you could see that in the models if you only looked at one by two.
Right, but that's, I don't see that actually.
Well, you can ask the question of whether, you know, in two states that are space-like separated, in one quantum state, it's the same expectation value. Are those space-like separated in all quantum states?
For example.
Yeah.
So we haven't considered that. It sounds like an interesting question.
I just to go back to
the
but is this metric is, if you put in all the x-dependence, the metric is still time-independent, is that right?
Yes. It's still static. That's why we're calling them degenerate states.
I think there's two different issues. You're not going to see operators using a space-like separation by just looking at zero. It's non-static. But yet, the metric depends on how they're all finite-dimensional. So that's the actual variable.
Yeah, but those are all different questions.
Right.
Okay. Well, I was going to... Now, just kind of rapidly go over the test particle construction. And one of the things that was interesting here was how there is a history of classical treatment of how to describe a classical spinning test particle in general relativity. And how the answer that you get when you use that formalism to study probes in one of these backgrounds, that it's really very nicely mirrored by the treatment via a supersymmetric particle or M2 brain. So the idea, again, for unraveling the test, the force balance, is we have these multi-object solutions. But to talk about things like force, at least one way, probably the simplest way, is to consider the background of one black hole, and some other object that's endowed with the same charges. So if I have a black hole with mass, charge, and spin, I want a test particle with mass, charge, and spin, and I want to look for the conditions for that test particle to be static, if there are any. Okay. Because for test particles, we have a F equals ma type equation, and we know how to use the word force. Okay. So for example, first let's take a spin away. If you just have the MP solutions, Q equals M, multi-black holes, no charge, one way you can, the statement that goes with our understanding of force balance there is that the Coulombic force balances the Newtonian kind of gravitational potential. So what do we really mean by that statement? Is that we take the the Lorentz force law. So I take the Maxwell force, instead of just using the geodesic equation because I want to use a test charge particle, use the Lorentz force, so we know how to handle a test particle with charge. And if you look at this test particle in the background of an extremal Q equals M black hole, no spin now, then you find that you have static solutions, and if you write this out, you have a Newtonian piece coming from the Christoffel symbols on the left-hand side, and the Coulombic piece on the right-hand side, and they cancel. Okay. So we can understand the force balance in that simple case. What we want here is to have test particles with not only mass and charge, but also spin. And it turned out that there's this enormous literature. The first stuff that I started reading, I mean, I didn't really delve into it, but started with the article by Papapetru. And that, I think, was 1951. And that work was extended by Dixon in a nice form. Papapetru looked at an extended object in gravity. So we have this nice blob, and it's described by some stress energy team you knew, which can, it was charged, it has mass, and it can include bulk rotation. And then he looked, by using gravity mean conservation of energy equals zero, he looked at the test particle limit, okay, and got out a kind of equation of motion for a test particle with spin. Dixon also worked on this problem and ended up with an equation in which your particle is endowed with all multiple moments that you might want to consider. So you can have a dipole, quadrupole, and so forth moments on your object. So I'll stop with the spin. This, the terms that if you just have charge and spin, so from just the spin, you get this Riemann tensor term, and this is going to couple to the spin of the particle. And then if the particle is charged, of course you have the Lorentz term, but being charged, since it has a spin, it also has a Maxwell-type term that will be the dipole-dipole term. And then there's a factor out in front. That's the charge to mass ratio and the gyromagnetic ratio G divided by 2. Okay. So this is the equation that results from these folks' work, and it's for a particle with a spin tensor, charge, and gyromagnetic ratio G. Now, I guess it was about 72, Bob Wald looked at just the spin-spin interaction. So he had a background space-time, a spinning black hole that had mass and angular momentum, and using this equation looked at a neutral test particle that has mass and spin and evaluated just the spin-spin force. There was no charge, so the other things didn't come in. And Bob wrote down an expression, and one of the things he observed was, hey, the form of this expression is exactly the same as if you look up in E.G. Jackson for a magnetic dipole-dipole force, except the sign is the other sign. Okay. Now, of course, because he was looking at neutral particles, there wasn't any force balance in this case, but what he had identified is that the gravitational spin-spin interaction has the right form to be canceled by a magnetic dipole-dipole interaction. So it's no surprise that if you actually look in the background of a space-time that has a black hole with mass and charge and angular momentum and look at a test particle with mass, charge, and angular momentum, that there's a chance for the spin force to balance the magnetic dipole-dipole force. And if you look at the IWP space-times, Israel, Wilson, Perges, which is just the Q equals M point on the Kerr-Newman family. So if you look at those space-times, so those have Q equals M and L of your choice, and look at a classical test particle and put it into this equation, what you find is that the force on the test particle depends on the product of these two spin tensors. So you have the spin of the background times the spin of the particle. And then there's a factor that cancels when the charge to mass ratio of the particle is 1, charge to mass of your background is 1, and when the gyromagnetic ratio of your particle is 2. Okay. So that you can kind of explicitly use this Dixon-Papapetri formalism to compute what the force is on the spinning test particle and see that one of these terms comes from the gravitational bit, one of them comes from the Maxwell bit, and they're exactly right to cancel in the Q equals MKs. I might point out that it's built into the background space and the gyromagnetic ratio is 2, so that doesn't appear. In this formalism for the test particle, the G for the test particle is a free parameter, and again, you have to set that equal to 2 to get the force balance.
Is that just the spin force looked at? You've already canceled out.
Yeah, okay. So this was the F spin plus F magnetic dipole.
Was this sort of guaranteed to work from the fact that the IWT metrics allow you to superpose many of these spinning black holes in various places? So if you take one of the black holes and let it pass and try to get really small, you think that it's
a... Well, exactly. And I don't know if it's... This, I think, is easier to do this way, to construct the test particle than to take the test particle limit. But I actually haven't done the latter calculation. So that might be possible, too.
Yeah, we were just trying to check if there was a kind of test particle explanation of why that happened.
So I'll finish up by saying a couple words about how the superparticle works. So Eichelberg and Embacher, after they did this first paper where they construct the exact space-time, did this, I think it's in 1988, they came out with this, like, it was like, you know, you have a soliton, you have daughter of soliton, bride of soliton, son of soliton. I think there was a sequence of papers in which they did an enormous amount of work, and they're very nice papers. And when they worked out what the superparticle action should be to describe, if you wanted to take one of their space-times, Q equals M black holes with gravitational fields, and just get the long-distance physics of that right by describing that as a particle. So since it's so late, I'll just say that they did the superparticle, and that in our calculation we use as a test probe a super test two brain. Okay, by test I just mean that you don't take into account the back reaction due to the probe on the gravitational field. Both of these have Lagrangians that are the form you've generalized to superspace what the action is along the world line. This is, instead of the world volume of either the particle line or the tube brain, it's a kind of super volume. And then you have a gauge piece allowing your particle, since it's charged, to couple to the gauge field of the appropriate dimension. The particle is, of course, supersymmetric and satisfies this other symmetry, Kappa symmetry, which you can think of from the point of view that Eichelberg and Embacher derive it as the remnant in the particle case of this fact that you start out with a space-time that only has half broken, half unbroken supersymmetry. So that cuts the number of fermionic degrees of freedom in half, and that shows up as this Kappa symmetry in the particle metric. So what we found when we looked at Eichelberg and Embacher's calculation and when we did this calculation for the M2 brain, is that the force balance for example, in the black hole case, which is most familiar, works out exactly the same way. This is for the classical particle. For the super particle, you get precisely the same expressions with the identification of Sij, the spin of the particle now, is an operator. And that's the fermionic coordinate of the particle, some gamma matrix stuff, and the conjugate momentum to theta. Okay. So that the superparticle spin variable becomes an operator, and otherwise the expression is just the same, with one other nice feature, that the gyromagnetic ratio, there's no free parameter for that in the superparticle action. That comes out automatically also to be G equals 2. So I thought it was kind of neat the way that the superparticle works just exactly the same. I wouldn't even want to say whether one was simpler or not. It's definitely an enormous amount of work to work out the Lagrangians and the interactions for both the test frame and the particle. But you might, depending upon your point of view of physics, you might think that the superparticle or the supermembrane are kind of more fundamental in some sense. Anyway, to get G equals 2 without having to put it in. Nice feature. So we looked at the situation to test M2 brains in the background of a big gravitating M2 brain. And there, when you're looking for static configurations, there's one more little twist that you have to, since there's more orientations that a 2-brain can have in 11 dimensions relative to the background, you have to guess at what the static ones will be. And we just chose the static ones that were parallel because those are the ones in which you have multi-object solutions. And things, there's more indices, there's more lines, but things, the physics kind of works out pretty much the same in terms of the force cancellation for the 2-brain. So I'm going to wrap up, and I think since I've exceeded my hour and I don't want to violate our contract.
There's no contract.
Since we've talked about most of the points quite a bit, I think I'll just throw out one last thing, one interaction that I found particularly interesting or charming or whatever. That comes back to some of these questions of how we interpret the metric that has these operators in it. So in the interactions for both the M2 brain case and the black hole case, you can pick an additional one out that actually changes the spin, allows the two objects in question, say two black holes, to change their spin via exchange of a gravitino. So once you have these operators and you realize that they're operators, then you're not obliged to only take excitation values. You can take matrix elements. So you can compute, for example, what the rate would be for this black hole to give up its unit of spin to this black hole via gravitino exchange by taking, there is an interaction that takes you from one of those states to another. So I thought that was kind of neat. You have this box of black holes, and so they all have the same energy and charge. They do interact in this way where they exchange spin. I'll stop there. Unless there are more questions.
I have a question. Can I just point out one extra element of the intriguing interaction? So usually, so in this, you're allowed an exchange of spin between the test particle and the background object. So usually you don't think of the test object as being able to affect a background object. Here, the spins are of the same order of magnitude. They're both quantum mechanical spins. And you treat, so you're not, somehow the spin of the test object is not treated as a test with respect to the spin of the background. And there are operators that couple the two together and then can change the value of each of them. I thought that was interesting.
Amanda? Well, I'm not sure which is more natural, but Eichelberg and Embacher, as I recall, don't use the word toposymmetry. They were starting with their space-times and trying to get the long-distance physics right and respect certain symmetries that they thought a particle action should have. And since in the space-times you start out with, your fermionic degrees of freedom are the number of dynamical ones are half the total possible degrees of freedom because of the projection conditions. They built that into their superparticle action.
That answers my question. So the point is that there would be a priori in the superparticle action twice the fermionic degrees of freedom is unique. And you're saying that the background provides the natural suggestions for this.
Well, we're seeing all the things is that any time you break a symmetry, there's going to be a non-linear symmetry that you can write down and realize it's a broken symmetry. Right? And Kappa symmetry can be the non-linear broken symmetry associated with supersymmetry. But that's all Kappa symmetry is. That could be normal that if the potential breaks, if I break symmetry by having sort of negative half potential, then there's something that can take me down the valley. That thing that takes me from one solution to another solution on the valley is some kind of symmetry. It takes from solution to solution. And you may need to gauge it. That's the kind of thing that's interesting. It's a redundancy of categorization.
As Gary pointed out, I mean, in some sense, shifts can be looked at as a test of the correctness of this when you test particle equations of motion. Because you, an exact theory are equilibrium, so you just take a limit. And in fact, if the test particle equations of motion also give the same answers and answers. But one might wonder if, in fact, there are other solutions to just test particles which don't come from the full theory or something.
The other static configurations?
Well,
so that's a good question, and we haven't checked that, but you could check different orientations,
right.
And maybe you could use that as a clue for finding other exact solutions. I mean, anyway, there'd be a minimal requirement that you would need to have some other static requirement. Yeah.
Is that formula valid for any Q, Q, M, and M?
Yeah, so this one, even though I said I was doing it for M equals Q, the answer, you could take a general care space-time. So this is actually a large R. So you take anything that asymptotes to a charge rotating black hole metric, and the far field of that interaction will give you this. So then you can read off the conditions you need for equilibrium. Well, the simplest way to get these to cancel is to have this be one and this one, simplest conceptually. I mean, you could have other configurations that would be static. Somehow I would guess that when you move them closer, something's going to get ruined because the Q equals M condition is the one for the big objects, gravitating objects, and you can put them anywhere. So this is the far field. If you chose other parameters by which you could actually get that to vanish, you might find that if you looked at it closer, then it wouldn't. I'm just guessing at that.
So I would guess that all these things that you generate this way with your different spins fill out some sort of super bowl with it.
Right. Do you know if there's precisely one spin zero?
We didn't fully analyze it. Yet it's 256 dimensional space of space. And it looks like there were two scalars.
The issue is you've broken the 11 dimensional space of space. The initial 16 dimensional solution was 16. But the interesting here is decomposing under the transverse rotation group.
But it's 99.
No. The supersymmetry is broken with the 11 dimensional supersymmetry.
Right.
But now you want to decompose that in SO9 representation. So the question is, if you have the 256 dimensional representation of SO16, how many scalars does it have under decomposition under SO9? Okay. That's the answer that's going to be.
That's two. And that must also be the answer to my other question, which was not on your work, but you mentioned this calculation of Mike Dutton, but it was found that there was no spin zero part of this zero brain, dependent. And that began the fact that...
But there are no scalars in the appropriate decomposition of the transfer script. What's the transfer script then?
Well, it's just a part of
the part. Sure, so the transfer script is a break. And so... It's a 9, sorry. It's a 9. Yeah. And so if you...
Well, I think you did describe about what the transfer script was for the M2 break.
Subtraction, I don't do it much anymore.
You know, we got started on this because we were reading this stuff paper and we saw these metrics that have these grassman objects in the middle of them, and we wondered, well, what are these things? You know, how do you get numbers for metrics?
Yeah, it's an odd thing that there is, although we think of the D-Dur brain as a point particle spherical symmetric solution, really there is no spherical symmetric D-Dur brain. There can't be a representation of it. It's just not a representation of SO, what is it?
David, did you?
I was just wondering, in the boson sector, it looks like you can put Fallon waves on the frame. So I was wondering whether you can still do that when you have fermions, and if so, whether you would expect to get a force balance law between the traveling wave on the big frame and the traveling wave on the test frame.
That's a good question. So is it known if the traveling wave solutions exist when you have the multi-M2 brains, for example, you can have them on both? That's known.
Yeah. So I expect you to still be able to do the same transformation.
That's a good
question.
Thank you for coming. I don't know.